Blog Talk Radio.
This broadcast is the property of E2G Sports Network, E2GSports.com, and E2G Sports LLC.
And welcome to another edition of the Ear to the Ground Sports Podcast on blogtalkradio.com. E2G Sports Network and E2GSports.com is where you find this podcast and all of our others. We're live at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on Monday, March 29th of the year 2021. John Crow and I on our old school podcast, and we're talking some NCAA men's college basketball. It is down to the Elite Eight, and we're right away to talk some NCAA college basketball tournament as a bracketologist from CBSSports.com at JP Palm on Twitter, and he joins us right now. Jerry Palm is on the other side. Jerry, John and John here. How are you doing today?
I'm doing all right. It's JP Palm CBS on Twitter.
I'm sorry about that. JP Palm CBS on Twitter. My apologies, but he's the man himself.
Sure.
Jerry, let's start with the Elite Eight, man. Obviously, the Pac-10 is looking really good coming in, but the surprise out of all these teams right now, tell me about Oregon State. I mean, getting hot at the right time, because they wouldn't be dancing if they did not win their conference tournament.
Yep, that's right. And it just goes to show that, strange things happen. I mean, we didn't see this out of Oregon State all year, and then all of a sudden, you know, they win three in a row. Beating good teams all the way to win their conference tournament, and then get into the conference tournament and are able to take advantage. It's been a remarkable run for the Beavers. They're going to have their hands full with Houston, but you know it's not unthinkable that they couldn't beat Houston the way they've been playing. You know they've shown that they can beat some pretty good teams. So you know Houston will have a shot at them. They're a very difficult team to play. Because their defense is so good and they rebound very well, so they really make you uncomfortable offensively. So we'll see what Oregon State can do about that.
Jerry, sticking with the Pac-12, UCLA with the upset of number 2 Alabama this weekend, and I got to ask you because everybody's asking. UCLA survived what happened late in that regulation, not fouling with the 3. I know it bugs me because it happens. Providence, Ned Cooley. They don't like to foul. Where do you sit on that before we get into the rest of the game?
I'm okay either way. It's, it can work against you as well. But it has to be something that you practice, right? I mean, if your strategy is typically to foul on that play, you have to practice that. Because the danger is, first of all, that you foul too late and you're giving them 3 free throws. Of course, with Alabama, that probably would have been a good idea because they lost the game because they couldn't shoot free throws. But, if you don't want to play that way, that's fine. Don't play that way. If you think you can D it up or keep them from getting a good shot, then that's fine too. But you just need to do it, whichever way you practice.
Jerry Palm, CBSSports.com, joined us here on the Ear to the Ground Sports Podcast. Jerry, sticking with UCLA, obviously, you win 6 games, you're cutting down the nets in a normal year, but want to be in one of the first 4 in, they're going to have to win 7. But that's a pretty impressive stat right there. I think one of the couple of teams who've done it, but no seniors on the court for this team come Tuesday when they take on the Wolverines.
Yeah, which obviously bodes well for next year, right? For UCLA not having any seniors. You don't see too many teams that young get this deep in the tournament, but that's a problem for next year. That doesn't really mean much now other than there might be times you'd want that experience, but even that doesn't really matter anymore once you get this deep into the tournament. They're trying to do something that only VCU has done, and that is go from first 4 to the final 4. And VCU did that in 2011, which was the first year of the first 4. A remarkable run for Shaka Smart's team that year, and now Mick Cronin has got his guys really against the run of play because they lost 4 in a row going into the NCAA tournament. So it's funny, we talk about Oregon State getting hot at the right time. They had to get hot to win the conference tournament just to get in and then take advantage of it. And then a lot of people feel like, well, if you're not hot going into the NCAA tournament, you're not going to do well. And here we've got UCLA, who couldn't have been any colder going into the conference or the NCAA tournament. And they're in the Elite Eight as well. So you can do it either way, but UCLA has picked the right time to get hot.
You talk about teams getting hot, teams getting cold. be remiss if I didn't ask you about Loyola of Chicago. Was it just a bad day at the office, shooting 5 for 23 from threes, missing 7 free throws? I mean, you know, obviously a Cinderella story, probably seeded lower than, you know, what they were supposed to be. Maybe they, you know, maybe would have been a 5th or 6th seed, seeded at 8. But what'd you make it? Just a bad day at the office?
Well, I first of all disagree with your premise that they should have been seeded higher. You could make an argument they should have been seeded lower. But there's no real argument for them to be seeded higher. Their best wins all year, Drake 2 out of 3 when Drake was shorthanded. So, you know, yeah, they lost to Wisconsin by 15. They lost to Richmond. You know, they didn't do anything to deserve a higher seed than an 8. Now, they took advantage of it, were able to beat Illinois, which is great. I think Oregon State showed it. They played a lot of zone against Loyola, who probably hasn't seen very much zone this year. That probably bothered them some. You know, their defense was good. I mean, Loyola is the top defensive team in the country in terms of points allowed all year, and I don't think their defense let them down. They just couldn't find ways to score. So part of it, I think, was just a bad day, but part of it might have been that Ohio State's defense gave them some looks that they hadn't seen.
Terry Palm joining us on the Ear to the Ground Sports Network. Another California team, Western Pac-12 team in USC, Jerry, getting solid guard play from Taj Eddie and Isaiah White, but this kid Mobley is a stud. He's only a freshman. Are we going to see this guy in the NBA sooner than later?
Oh, yeah, next year, for sure.
Okay.
He's going to be a very high draft pick. He's going to probably be in the top 5. He's a fantastic talent, and he's got an inside and outside game. So, you know, he'll be in pretty good shape in the NBA next year, but right now the concern is, of course, him and his twin brother leading USC to a possible Final Four. And they'll be an interesting challenge for Gonzaga because I don't know that Gonzaga's, you know, seen as athletic a big guy. I mean, they saw Luka Garza, and he's a, you know, terrific big, but he's not as athletic as Mobley. So it'll be interesting to see what Gonzaga can do to try and neutralize him and continue their dominant run through this tournament.
When you talk about Gonzaga, obviously, number one overall, I mean, where do you see the people, the team, where is their stumbling block, if there is one, the rest of the way?
Well, I would think most likely it would be Baylor, but of course Baylor has to get there, and they're 2 wins away. I think USC can give them some problems. The way that USC has been playing in this tournament, they've been playing very well on both ends of the floor. And I think they're going to, you know, if they continue to do that, they're going to challenge Gonzaga. But Gonzaga's offense is so good. It's so versatile. There isn't – you can't pick a guy. I mean, you know, Timmy's an All-American and Kispert's an All-American and Suggs is an All-American. You know, but you can't just, you know, try and pick one or two of those guys. All 5 guys can hurt you. You know, Nebhard can hurt you. Everybody they put on the floor can score. And they're not deep. Gonzaga's not deep. So maybe, you know, the best plan is to try and get them into foul trouble. But, you know, it's the way that they score, they're in every game.
Jerry Palm joined us here on the Ear to the Ground Sports Podcast at GP Palm CBS. Michigan Wolverines, well-coached, but kind of surprising me. I thought the loss of Isaiah Livers would really hamper this team, but they just keep on trucking through it.
Yeah, and that's actually the game where I thought that was possible because of the way Florida State pressures you with their defense full court. The problem for Florida State was they weren't generating enough offense. In order to do that full court press, you actually have to score. And they weren't scoring. They didn't have a lot of time to set up a press. And Michigan handled them really well. It was more of a half court game, which really suited Michigan. And they've been outstanding in this tournament. They were again against, you know, Florida State, and now they get an 11 seed UCLA that they should physically outmatch. I mean, I don't know what UCLA is going to do with Hunter Dickinson. They certainly don't have a guy that seems that could play him. But, you know, the other guys are going to have to play well, too. And we'll just have to see. But Michigan has to be considered a heavy favorite against UCLA.
Sticking with Michigan, Jerry, and how ironic is it that, you know, on the football side, you had, you know, Harbaugh coming in with all the fanfare. He's going to bring everything back on the gridiron. And here comes Juwan Howard. He's got his team 1 step away from the Final Four.
Yeah, he's done a terrific job coming into Michigan. He's recruited well. He's coached well. He's managed the program well. There really isn't a lot of criticism really at all for what Juwan Howard has done, even to nitpick. That he's done a great job at Michigan, and they're well set up to do well beyond this year. So it's not like a, you know, this has been a magic year or something for them. This is something we ought to start getting used to.
Jerry Palm joined us on our E2G Sports Podcast here, talking Elite Eight NCAA men's basketball style. Jerry, you talk about Michigan taking down Florida State, but I looked at a really disparaging difference in free throws. I always raise an eyebrow when one team, in this case Florida State, only attempts 6 free throws, while the other team, Michigan, obviously making the best out of it, stepped to the stripe 23 times. Is that just style of play, coincidental? Because Florida State's a physical team.
Well, they weren't physical enough, or maybe they were too physical, and that's why Michigan shot so many free throws.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably a bit style of play, and it's probably a bit a lack of aggression on offense from Florida State, because usually you have to be aggressive to draw fouls, and just that perhaps they just weren't, you know, aggressive enough to draw fouls. But yeah, a lot of people point to free throw disparity and say that that's the fault of the officials, but the officials are just there to call what they see. They're not there to hand out free throws evenly. That almost never happens.
Jerry, going to ask you, I happen to be one who looks at this tournament. Obviously, with the pandemic, it's been different. But with the shifting of days, I kind of like it going, you know, the back end going into Monday and Tuesday. I know, again, it's a once-in-a-lifetime pandemic. But would the NCAA look at kind of tweaking this tournament to adjust a little bit moving forward?
No. No, they can't wait to get back to the way it was. there's no way. When we have this tournament next year, the first four will be Tuesday and Wednesday in Dayton, and then we'll be back to the Thursday, Sunday. TV ratings are always going to be better on Thursday than they are on Monday anyway. So, there's no way. We're keeping the same schedule.
Jerry Palm, CBSSports.com, joining us talking some NCAA basketball. Shaka Smart, like you said, leaving Texas to become the head coach of Marquette. How cream of a job is the Texas Longhorn basketball head coaching job? And who do you – are you hearing any front runners in your circles or who may become the next coach there?
No, I haven't heard any names. I mean, there's a lot of speculation about who would be good candidates. And, you know, those names are pretty well out there. I would put Chris Beard at the top of that list. Well, I believe it's a Texas alum, you know, but that's one of those in conference and not just in conference, but in state moves. So those are a little tricky, but that would probably have to be the first guy on their list. And for Shaka, you know, going to Marquette, I think it's a good move for him too. It feels like a step back really, because Texas has got such great resources in it and could be, you know, primed to be a powerhouse underneath, you know, the right leadership. But Shaka probably never really fit in there very well, and he's from Wisconsin. So Marquette is a great landing place for him, and he doesn't have to worry about all the hot seat talk next year after this season's disappointing end in the NCAA tournament.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry, my last question for you, and thanks for the time. Another coaching move, Mike Woodson in Indiana. Looks like Thad Matta will join him as an associate AD. What do you make of that move?
Well, I'm a little confused by Thad Matta as an associate AD. I don't know what his – I mean, it kind of sounds like he'd be Woodson's boss, which, you know, I don't know if that's, you know, what they intended or not, or if he's just really a glorified consultant with a fancier title. But, you know, Mike Woodson has been a successful coach in the NBA, is both an assistant and a head coach. He's got a ton of experience. So for him, you know, the difference, it would be like with Juwan Howard. Although Woodson coached in the NBA longer, he's older and has been in the league longer. You know, the difference is the administration and the recruiting aspect of college. I mean, coaching basketball is coaching basketball, and he shouldn't have any trouble with that part of it. So, you know, and that may be what Mata is there to help him do, is help him manage, you know, the difference, you know, between college and the NBA, the administrative aspect of it. But it's a, really, I guess my only concern is that he's 63 years old already. So is this really a long-term hire? I know we've got a couple guys coaching in their 70s in college basketball, and Mike Krzyzewski and Jim Boeheim off the top of my head. But, you know, you wonder how long, even if he's successful, how long is Mike Woodson going to be there?
Jerry Palm joins us here. Jerry, final question for me, very simply. Who do you like advancing to the Final Four? Who you got cutting down the nets come Monday?
Well, Gonzaga. My pick all along, still sticking with Gonzaga, beating now Baylor in the final, joined by Michigan and Houston. So the four top seeds left, I guess.
Cream always rises to the top. Jerry, thank you for your time today. Always appreciate it. We'll talk to you down the road. Be well. Stay safe, sir.
All right. Thanks. Take care.
You bet. That was Jerry Palm. You can read his good stuff. Yeah, Jerry's good, man. He pioneered all this bracketology stuff back in the day and breaking it down. Remember you and I remember from the college RPI days back in the score.
Oh, yeah.
And it was great stuff, and he broke it down with the best of him, and it was like, wow, this is pretty cool. But he's a self-anointed geek. He's played his clarinet. Look on his Twitter page at JP Palm CBS, and he's self-anointed. But I like him. He has an opinion, and his stuff is really good, and it comes through in his work, and you can always hear and read his stuff on CBSSports.com. But, hey, you know what? John has some good stories in this tournament, man, and – it's funny too. You go back to Loyola of Chicago, who was a Cinderella just 2 years ago, and they were the favorite, playing a Cinderella seed and losing to an Oregon State. So it's amazing how tide can turn, and that's what makes this tournament one of the many things that make it such a very it's an event now, like the Super Bowl. It goes on for 2 weeks.
Yeah, and it does. And I had to throw Jerry the softball about the NCAA tournament changing everything. Again, I'm one of the few who likes it going into Monday and Tuesday. I know they're never going to change it because the NCAA is not going to, you know, ratings are always higher, you know, early, you know, on that Thursday, because Thursday is the most important night in all of television.
No question.
I like it ending on Monday and Tuesday. I'm not going to walk away from that because I like it. I like it.
No, me too. I'm right there with you because you're right. I mean, it's Monday and Tuesday, usually a slow day outside of baseball season. That's coming up. But, you know, you have basketball and hockey, and that's different. But when you have college basketball on a Monday and Tuesday in the Elite Eight, I'm all geeked up again. I'm getting my food ready. I'm going to be parking my butt on my couch about an hour before tip-off and loving it. I'm going to watch the last two games on the CBS Sports March Madness app, which I have, which is great. You can see all the games in its entirety. I'm right there with you, John. You stumble upon these things to make the best out of a bad situation. We saw it with football, some Tuesday night games, some Wednesday night games. It was kind of cool in a way. Maybe the novelty wouldn't be as good in about 4 or 5 years, but I'm liking this. I'm right there with you. And you're right. So enjoy it. It's probably going to be the only time it happens. God forbid something else in the world comes up. But Monday and Tuesday basketball for the right to show up in the Final Four, I'm loving it.
Let's just hope we're not talking about bubbles and, you know, moved schedules for the 2022 NCAA tournament.
No question about it. I'm right there with Jerry, though. I mean, Gonzaga looks so strong. I mean, it's obviously they're going to have to – I mean, you can't run with them because they average almost 85 points a game right there. So you've got to slow it up. Mm-hmm. You've got to play the half-court offense. And they haven't been tested there yet. And we're not so sure because – they're so strong in every asset that they may not be able to slow up in a half-court game with all the talent they have. Suggs, Timmy, I mean, this team is one of the better teams I've seen in a long time, head to toe.
Yeah, and you know, they just have that chip on their shoulder right now that, hey, you know, it's nice we're in the Elite Eight, but that's nothing. You know, we've got more work to do here, and they understand that. And so they right from the get-go, they haven't had that, you know, typical high-seed, close game, get into the final 2 minutes in the early rounds and get that scare out of the way. You know, now they've been full, you know, pedal to the metal the whole way, and I don't expect anything to change. I'm with Jerry. I think it's Gonzaga's to lose, but, you know, Baylor could give them a run. Michigan's right there, so, you know, let's play it out.
I agree, and yeah, you referenced UCLA, and I lived in LA, man. I think it's kind of neat to have UCLA and USC with a chance to be on one side of the bracket in a Final Four. I don't think it's going to happen, but it's neat. But UCLA, I think, dodged a bullet against a strong Alabama team, which is deep three all year long, up until the last shot, wasn't good at all in that game. And by the way, you're not going to win many games, pro or college, when you go 11 for 25 from the stripe. In a one-game situation, it's done, and that was their downfall. I think that was more indicative of Alabama not playing well. Credit give all credit to UCLA, but Alabama just wasn't their game, and they make a few more free throws, it may be a different story.
Yeah, and you look on the other side. You look at the Arkansas game. They don't shoot threes, and the light went off in that game where they decide, hey, we're going to feed it to Moody and Tate, and they turned around Oral Roberts, and I don't know about you, but I thought that last three by Asmus was going dead center to win that game against them.
Sure.
But, Arkansas, the light went off with Eric Musselman. He realized, okay, this is what we need to do if we're going to advance or if we're going to be on the sidelines for another Cinderella story. And so kudos to them, and, let's see what they get done tonight.
I agree. Three double-digit seeds in the Elite Eight, three Pac-12 teams. And if you told me that there'd be three Pac-12 teams at the beginning of this tournament in the Elite Eight, I would have told you you're crazy or you're lying or you're on something or both.
Oh, yeah, and UCLA trying to become just the second team since VCU back in 2011, the first year, to go as an 11 seed, first four to final four. I mean, that's incredible. And, let's see what they got against Michigan. It's going to be a tough road to hoe for them.
No question. And if you could, and people who are down on the first four, I like it now. If you don't think that's a tournament game, a lot of people don't. They wait till it's 64, so they think playing games are not. That's a tournament game, and just ask UCLA, because they're playing for a shot to the Final Four by winning that first four in against a gritty, heavily favored Michigan State team in that game.
Yeah, and I think the NCAA, actually, I'll give them credit for doing one thing. Remember when it first started, it was really the last four teams in, and it was like, all right, we'll just throw you a bone. You're 65 through 68. We'll let you get in. And then they kind of changed it around so they included at least a couple of named teams that were in that 11, 12 seeded area that were truly the last teams to get in the tournament. So it gives them some more interest and it gives them credibility. And you know what? If you're one of these teams from the Power Five conferences, yes, it's not a good thing to be a lower seeded team, but it almost helps you to get that one game in before your opponent plays later on in the week. It gives you that little bit of momentum.
Yeah, and momentum is alive and well always in an NCAA tournament. Look at Oregon State, who at one point the season was 11-11, and looking from the outside in, and you get the chance, you make the best of it, you're playing best basketball at the right time. All you need to do is go on a little hot streak, but it'd be kind of neat if UCLA somehow has to win seven games just to cut the nets down instead of the normal six. But I like that. I'm glad to give him credence to that final four, first four in, I should say. But you're right. Now you're seeing big-name teams who are literally, like Michigan State and UCLA, big-name schools, power conferences, who are the last to get in because they weren't going to be in otherwise. So, it's not these lowly middle American conference teams who are, like you said, throwing a bone to, and they let them in the tournament because it's a no, because it's like no shot at beating a team that they're going to face. They're usually a 16 seed coming in, but you have power teams in that. It lends credence to it. I like that about the NCAA. So they did get some things right. Agreed.
They did. We throw them a bone every once in a while, blind squirrel finds a nut every once in a while, and that's the NCAA, right?
That's it. Being a good neighbor, my friend. He's Jeff Goh. I'm Johnny Sanchez. On our Monday version of the Old School Podcast, going old school with Chips and Crow. It is Monday. We are coming to you live at 1:23 Eastern on March 29th of the year 2021 on the E2G Sports Network, also blogtalkradio.com. And this podcast and everyone will be available on E2GSports.com. And if you listen to us live, we'd love to get your input on college basketball. Tell us your brackets. I smashed mine a long time ago. Want to talk some baseball? Opening days up a couple away. COVID issue in baseball we'll get to. You want to talk any wrestling? John's big into wrestling, as I am as well. Whatever you want to talk to, please do. 516-387-1702. Once again, 516-387-1702. John, the story here this week in the NFL, we got to talk some NFL because, our old prodigal son named Jimmy Garoppolo, Niners quarterback, and the Niners pulling that big move this week, moving up into the draft to solidify the number 3 overall pick. And woo, you should have heard the teeter-totters and the celebrations. I heard a couple of cannons and fireworks. Jimmy G's coming to New England. Whoa, here he comes. Put the brakes on that. I want your thoughts on it because I don't think he's going anywhere. But the Niners now have the number three pick and changes the whole aspect and the whole input of what's going to happen in the draft.
Let me just say this. If only if it were that simple for him to get out of San Francisco and come to New England, I think he'd want it. He'd enjoy it. He may have to lose some of that $25 million that, you know, is supposed to be coming his way this year. But I'll be honest, I got to disagree with you, Chips. If the Niners, after all this, if they're not targeting one guy, which I think they are, and his name is Mac Jones, at number three, Lynch and Shanahan will be at his pro day, part two, because Alabama, you're so big, you need two pro days. He's going to be throwing again tomorrow. They're going to be there instead of being with Justin Fields at Ohio State. I think it's their guy. I don't think they're going to have a situation where they go after Trey Lance and let him sit behind Jimmy Garoppolo because it's, I just don't see it working for them. You've made all this effort to get up to number three. You've had some issues between Shanahan and Garoppolo. And, you know, I mean, just look at it. I don't think he's the guy that Shanahan thought he was going to be. Mm-hmm. We all know that Shanahan likes his Kirk Cousins type. And that's Mac Jones, you know, can make all the throws, does his pre-snap reads, very smart. I think he's the guy that they're going to go after. And if you're drafting a guy at three, you're not letting him sit a year to go pay somebody else $25 million. I just don't see that happening. The question for the Patriots is, how do you get him out?
Yeah, that's right. So the question has to be answered with a question first, or are they going to get rid of him? Buddy Andre is going to join us too. Buddy, I want to get your opinion on this too, because here's my argument. You're 1 year removed as a team from a Super Bowl. You were injured last year in the COVID season, say what you want. But San Francisco, when healthy, right now with Garoppolo, is a Super Bowl contender, in my opinion. And why do you – to me, you just can't give that up right away. You let Jimmy play one more year. If you're going to get a quarterback, you groom in. But that's going to take some big cojones by one Kyle Shanahan, if that's the case, because the inmates are not going to be sitting pretty, so to speak, on that team, for lack of a better term. And I just think you're taking a Super Bowl contender and you're basically saying – not throwing it away, but you're taking him a step back at least. Buddy, your thoughts on this too, as Buddy Andrew joins us here, our draft guru on the E2G Sports Network old school podcast with Chips and Crow. Bud, sir, what's up?
Hey, guys. Great interview with Terry Palm. I get to listen to most of it.
Thanks, sir.
After some food shopping. But he's going to be here. Jimmy G is going to be here. There's going to be someone drafted later on. And my two predictions are either Kyle Trask or Davis Mills is a developmental guy, and I think it's Jimmy Cam, developmental guy. Stidham to Houston is something that I've heard recently. If Deshaun Watson is traded, or two, he's put on the commissioner exempt list, there's a possibility he could be going to Houston, and that came to me from a really good source.
So, what are the Patriots going to have to do to get Garoppolo here outside of that 15th pick?
I had written an article the other day. They're having a problem with the 46. I think their best partner is the Jacksonville Jaguars, who have won 25, 33, and 65. I wrote up a trade where the Pats trade 15, 46, and their fourth-round pick, they flip with Houston for 25, 33, and 65, and a seventh-round pick late. And I'll get into that seventh-round pick because I think this is something a lot of people don't think about when you get late in the draft. You flip. You say to them, we meet in the middle. We're not giving you 15. You're not taking 46. Here's 33. What that does for San Francisco is it puts them in the catbird seat. Because that team that has the 33rd pick, Fields calls all day on Friday from other teams for guys who just slipped out of the first round, didn't get picked. Guys are like, this guy slid. We have to go out and get him. I think this is the best way for San Fran to recuperate one of their first-round picks in the next 2 years, where you say, yeah, we'll give you 33, we'll take a one next year. And that is very, very possible. We've seen it happen before. We have examples of that. That 33 spot is a hot spot along with that first pick of the fourth round, because it's a new day and people, scouting rooms have had a chance to reevaluate everything and say to themselves, oh, my God, we have a second-round grade on this guy. It's the fourth round. We can grab this guy. Let's trade up to Jacksonville at whatever it is, 107, and try to make this happen. And the thing I like about that 249 pick at the end is part of this trade for the Patriots is you get into a situation. Last year, Carolina and New Orleans had a situation where they were both bidding for Tommy Stevens, the quarterback. They were trying to sign him as an undrafted free agent. And New Orleans traded back into the draft just to get his rights because they thought they were going to lose out to him to Carolina. So that point of the draft, you're looking to just get rights to guys who you and probably two other teams are dealing with on getting a rookie free agent contract. That's why these late compensatory seventh-round picks being tradable is just such a big deal at this point in time, something that it wasn't before.
And buddy, I got to agree with you. You make a lot of sense. When I read the article, when you wrote it a couple of days ago on ETGSports.com, if you haven't read it yet, do yourself a favor and read it because it makes perfect sense. I think the 15th pick for the Patriots, much too high. They got other you know, eyes set on that pick. Move it down. You know what? Go get a second or a third round pick. Maybe if you have to get another pick for next year, do that. They're more comfortable with it. Get Jimmy G here. Draft a quarterback in round two or three. Plus, the Niners look better for moving forward with the guy they want to move forward, whether it be Jones, whether it be Lance, whether it be Fields, whomever. But it makes sense on every level. And I got to ask you, buddy, with what you're hearing about Stidham, could it be Harry part of that move too to Houston?
Harry doesn't have a lot of interest from Houston. That could definitely change. I haven't heard him there. I've heard Washington, and one of the flips for that was it wouldn't be a pick. The Patriots really liked Antonio Gandy-Golden, who came out of Liberty last year and was drafted in the fourth round. And they also talked to Baltimore because they like Miles Boykin, who was a third-round pick in the same draft that Harry was a wide receiver. If you go back, the key thing when you look at these guys, and I hear these names, and the first measurable I go back to look at is what was their three cone when they tested at that point in time. And Boykin was under a seven, and same thing with Antonio Gandy-Golden was under a seven. So it kind of fits like what the Patriots do. And Gandy Golden would be that big outside receiver, and they can draft that slot middle receiver later on, or have Kendrick Bourne or Jacoby Myers do it this year.
Buddy Andres, draft guru on E2GSports.com, joined us. Buddy, you know, a lot of people are talking about San Francisco and what they did, but talk about the Dolphins, and we know they're up and coming, but you're looking at a team that is really setting themselves up well for a long period of success, and along with Buffalo, that's going to be a tough division once for the first time in a long time. So the Patriots need to make this move, I think, for Garoppolo to get it done, just based on the fact that the competing just for the division title is going to be tougher than it's been in a long time.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And you know what would totally change my mind on the Miami Dolphins? If last year, if the NFL draft, we had heard, and with the fifth pick, the Miami Dolphins select Justin Herbert, quarterback, Oregon.
Oh, could you imagine?
I think
that
they would be in a much better situation than they are right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't believe in Tua. I didn't believe in him beforehand, and people talk about Jimmy G being fragile. I mean, we're talking about Tua, who hurt his arm throwing a football.
Right. And I don't think the team believes in him as well. The coach said, and, you know, with the quarterback something they did last year, there was a little dissension on that team when Fitzpatrick, say what you want, was all he was doing was winning, having one of his better seasons statistically, and they were winning around it. They were coming, they were firing out of the huddle a little bit differently if you watch the game. They were responding to the quarterback. And when Tua was injected, kind of took a little steam out of it, in my opinion, just by the naked eye, seeing what was going on with the team. And they still were able to win 10 games with that team. So I don't think the coaching staff is as high on Tua as we thought going into last year as well.
Yeah, it's just not a fit. I don't know what it is. It's the eye test to me. It just doesn't pass it. Mm-hmm. It's the leadership. And a big part of it, too, is in mid-game, you go from a left-handed quarterback to a right-handed quarterback for receivers. So the ball's coming out different. There's different arm angles. You're running your routes a little bit different. You know, your stem at your route is different. That sucks to be a wide receiver when you go from a lefty to a righty. It really does. There is impact in that.
Sure.
Yeah, what I did like about what the Dolphins did, they check every box from after the trade with San Francisco, moving back to 12. They get the Eagles moved back into 6. And I hate it for the Patriots because it puts the Dolphins in play with that primo wide receiver / tight end, whether it's Pitts, whether it's Chase, Smith, Waddle, whomever they want to go. One of those guys is going to be there at 6. But it also keeps him in play with whomever quarterback they want to trade with, because obviously Watson with 19 lawsuits up to today, that's off the mix because he's probably, as you said, headed to the commissioner's list, you know, for whatever reason to start, whatever this unfolds to, you know, to start the season. But it keeps him in play to maneuver moving forward into next year if they want. But the Pats didn't do all that they've done so far to hand the keys to Cam Newton. Please, please tell me, Bill Belichick, that you're not going to feed us Cam Newton again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't go to the dealership and go to the new car section for your 17-year-old daughter who just got her license. You find somebody who find that car down the end there. Hey, it's a 2011. It's $5,000. Grandma drove it to bingo. Let's go take that. It may not be the most reliable car, but I'm not putting you in a new Chevy Tahoe. So that's kind of the way I look at that.
That's a good question.
Yeah,
good point, too.
To be honest, Belichick has a chip on his shoulder that he still wants to say, bleep you to Kraft and to Brady that, yeah, I was right. I did get the next guy right. It may have taken me a couple of years after, but I still know what I'm doing.
I think there's some big moments on the schedule. That'd be one of them. And that Tampa game is going to be something else. I think I truly believe, I said it before the offseason, he's loading up, if not just for that game this year. I mean, that is going to be something else. That is going to be one of the best weeks of prep, of pre-prep for a game we've ever had.
Going
to be fun.
The hype is going to be insurmountable in this area too, and that game is going to be. I'm rooting for this because, Buddy and John, you guys know that I'm down on the fan base here. When all of a sudden we forget what Bill Belichick did for 20 years, and all of a sudden we criticize everything he's done in his first losing season in about 20 of those years. So it'd be a great drop your mic moment for him to be successful. And JC, you pointed to it right. There you go. Take that. I had the guy before. Now I have him again. Look what I can do. I haven't forgotten how to coach. Bang. Don't let the door hit you where it split you, baby. See ya. I'm out. I'd love that. It's a great
redemption. Let's be honest.
Yeah.
Let's be honest.
Now,
where the NFL puts that game is huge.
That was the question I was just going to ask you, Crow, because I know you study this stuff. Is there still that TV sweeps week that they used to always put the Patriots-Colts Sunday night game on? Does that exist?
Yes and no. It's not as prevalent as it used to be because of the way, you know, digital puts into it. Ad rates are not geared towards that third week of November because obviously it used to be you had February, you had May, you had November as your huge sweeps in television. It's not so much now because everything is more geared towards digital and, you know, the amount of screens that you're on. But the NFL itself puts a huge amount of importance into the second and third week of November. So if they put the Pats in the Bucks early in the season, that tells you what the NFL thinks of the Patriots' chances, because if they think they're in it for the long haul, they will move Pats Bucks to November because they think that one, they know it's going to be an attraction wherever. But if they think it's going to be that ultimate competitive game between two really high-seeded teams headed into December, they're going to keep it in that November spot. So they know what's going on. They hear the rumblings. They know what teams are doing. So don't kid yourself that they don't factor in all these things. They know.
Oh, it's huge.
Yeah, they know it's huge. But that'll speak a lot of volumes of what they think about Bill Belichick and his moves in the offseason, who they have moving forward.
So, JC, let me ask you this. If Cam Newton is a starting quarterback for that game, is it a primetime game or not?
I think it's still a primetime game, but I think it's early in the season.
Okay.
Because I don't think they look at them with Cam Newton as a team that's going to be 17 games now, so, 13-4 type team. Will they be competitive playoff-wise? Yeah, but you have just as big a chance that Cam Newton is a flop again, and then you don't know what you get going on, and you're looking at a situation where the NFL has no interest in being in saying, oh, my God, we've got to flex out of a Patriots-Bucks-Tom Brady game because it's not what we thought we were, and we have another game that we want to boost up. So it will be very interesting to see what the schedule makers make for this season.
And, buddy, go ahead, buddy, I'm sorry.
No, I have a lot of deep-rooted issues, and when people hear me say this, they're going to go, there's something really wrong with you. My comparison to this game is Montana against the Niners, but that was a home game for the Chiefs, and that was a week 2, 1 o'clock kickoff in 1994.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you're getting that week 2, 1 o'clock kickoff for this game. Maybe more so because Brady's coming here, but that's the only comp I can look at in the schedule of a guy going back, or Brett Favre going back to Green Bay.
Right.
Comp could be the week 2 Sunday night game, though, here in New England, because obviously the Bucs are going to open up at home on that Thursday night week 1. So, you know what? It wouldn't surprise me. If everything stays the same and we don't have Jimmy Garoppolo here, we don't have that stud, early on in the first round coming to New England, no moves are made, and it's still Cam Newton, I could see week 2, Sunday Night Football, Brady here in New England.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't shock me at all.
Push it a little further. Just because that opening, I don't think they're going to let them open Thursday and then open Sunday night the next week. Usually they don't do that.
Right.
I'm big into the schedule and Czar. I follow him on every social media thing. Like, I'm looking in the background, like, trying to highlight, like, oh, dude, does he have a Week 15 game written in there so I can sneak it in, Just a general idea of what I'll be doing on that Sunday. But, yeah, I truly believe, what do you guys think of opening night? I think opening night is going to be the Bills at the Buccaneers.
Yep.
Agreed.
A super matchup. You got the loser of the AFC Championship game against the Super Bowl champions, and the history of Brady and the Bills. Like, that, I think, is the number one game for opening week. I think that's just a lock.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Go ahead, John. Finish up. I want to throw a Garoppolo question out at you guys.
Yeah, I was going to say, it checks all your boxes if you're a Patriots fan, because either way, it's a win. If the Bills lose, it helps you in the division. If Brady loses and you're on that side of the fence, then you know what? You get a little revenge coming back. So
there you go. It's a win-win. We can't lose. Hey, but I want to get your opinion on this. And, John, while you're here, because I wanted to bring this up on the show, all the disdain and all the venom that's out for a lot of good fans, some of the talking heads in the area, have for Jimmy Garoppolo. Granted, he's been injury-prone. I get that. But here's what kills me when they talk about that 2019 season, that some talking heads and people talk about how Jimmy Garoppolo was they didn't trust him at quarterback. That's why they ran the ball, this and that. And they ran the ball for 200 yards a game in the championship game against Green Bay. But it was more an indictment on how they didn't trust Garoppolo to throw the ball down the field as much as he could have. Now, let me ask you this. If you're Kyle Shanahan and you average 144 yards a game rushing season and do what you did in the playoffs against defenses, you wouldn't take the ball out of your running back's hands if you're running the ball well. My point is, the fact that they ran the ball well was not an indictment on how ineffective Jimmy Garoppolo was. And that seems to be the biggest misnomer. And when I hear people talk about that, it drives me up a wall. All the guy does when he starts is win 2 out of every 3 games he is in. There's something to be said for that. Buddy, I want to start with you, your opinion on that. And I just, because I'm a big Garoppolo guy, and the people just look, want to shovel dirt on this guy for something that is, in my opinion, not any, anything of his doing.
Yeah, to those people, I'm like, well, the Niners' defense carried them all the way to the Super Bowl in the run game. Well, here's three things I'm going to say. Game at New Orleans, needed for the number one seed. He outdoes Drew Brees.
Mm-hmm.
Week 17, they go to Seattle, the 1-5 seed up for grabs. San Francisco makes the tackle at the one. Jimmy G outperforms Russell Wilson in that game. In three, he comes back here with the Patriots, knowing all his weaknesses and the whole bit, and Bill Belichick game plan. Oh, my God, did he torch this place. Oh, my God. He lit the place on fire, stood there and watched it burn. Okay, so a lot of false narratives. And I don't know. I like winning. I think that's one of the biggest things is winning. I enjoy winning. 7-9 was not fun.
No.
And this guy's record, when he's on the field, is very good. Here, a year San Francisco didn't even want to put him on the field or win any games for a draft pick. And then after an ACL injury, the first year after an ACL injury,
mm-hmm.
He goes to the Super Bowl. And if you want to put everything good on that San Francisco defense for carrying him to the Super Bowl, then how about giving 21 points up in the fourth quarter in the last 8 minutes of a Super Bowl? Whose fault was that?
Good point. He wasn't on the field. JC, your thoughts?
Yeah, it's pretty simple to me. I mean, NFL coaches like to stick with what's working. The Packers in the Niners game, the Niners ran it for almost 300 yards.
285, baby.
I mean, you just don't walk away. And for Patriots fans, I will give you this. Take it back to overtime, Patriots-Chiefs, AFC Championship game. Ran the same play four straight times against the Chiefs to get down to finally run the ball in. You know why? Because it worked.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you do. You don't just do things just to placate things. You don't do it because, oh, my quarterback needs some, you know, he needs to throw some passes because, you know what, we're just running the ball too damn well. No. That's not what you do. You do something until the other team stops it. And if they don't, guess what? You keep doing it over and over and over. And, yeah, I mean, the only knock I have against Jimmy Garoppolo, yeah, he's been dinged up. You know, at some point, you have to get past that. And there are thousands of players through the NFL that have had that happen to them early on in their career and have gotten past it later
mm-hmm.
on. We'll see. There's no guarantee that he comes here and he's going to be healthy. But you know what? I will take that chance.
Buddy Andre, John Crow, Johnny Sanders here on the Old School Sports Podcast. And one, John, you made a good point. How many times do we see teams in the NFL defensively, I'm putting out, you know, like have a great game plan and they're shutting the team down for three quarters and yet they go out of the scheme that's been the key to their success in that game, in that moment. And you look at the Niners in that playoff push. They ran from 186 against Minnesota in the divisional game, 285 against the aforementioned Green Bay Packers, and 141 in the Super Bowl where he makes one throw and completes one throw to Emmanuel Sanders. They win the game. You don't go away from that if it's working. When you're running the ball for 4-8 a pop consistently, you're going two downs and you're getting a first down basically. You don't go away from that. But we can't criticize a team for sticking with something that's working. Pretty simple.
No, the run game is the ultimate. Like, if you can run the football, you don't stop running the football.
No.
You just don't. And especially in that situation, that 49ers Green Bay game, they were blowing guys 10 yards off the line. There was no contact till 8 yards off beyond the line of scrimmage. Most or any of those guys. I mean, they would just clear first downs. Like, I'd like to know how many third downs they actually faced in that game. It wasn't like they had to put the ball in his hand on third down because they weren't getting to third down.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree.
It's just because a pass isn't completed, too, and you go back to that Sanders pass, in the Super Bowl. Just because it's not completed doesn't mean it's the quarterback's fault.
Exactly.
There are so many other things. I mean, you look at that play again, and it's not like Sanders, he's behind the two defenders, but it's not like he's going full out to go get that ball. So, not to be a Jimmy G apologist, but, you know, as Tom Brady will be the first one to say, it's not always about the quarterback if things don't go well.
Right. Right. It's miserable fans looking for something to tag on to make their quote unquote argument against a player for or against, and that's basically what it is. I mean, regular season stats: he's 27-9 career, including the playoffs. 51 TDs, 26 INTs. Career averages 8.2 yards per attempt with almost a 68 completion percentage. That's a good quarterback. But maybe we haven't seen enough of Jimmy outside of that 16-game year because he has been injured. I think he may be a better quarterback than what we've seen.
I just go back to that Miami game in 2016. Mm-hmm. He got hurt on that Kiko Alonso hit into the shoulder. What he was doing in that first half of that game was wow. And I think that's what stuck in Belichick's mind was – he took a game plan, and boy, did he run with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was why I thought it was so tough for Bill to trade him, because he felt like he was the next guy.
Good point. And Tom Brady had several bowel movements during that sequence, I'll tell you that.
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead, Jay. You were going to say something.
Yeah, I mean, and even take it, you know, game before, opening up in Arizona. You know, everyone had that labeled as a loss. You know, oh, we'll look good, we'll be competitive. And you know what? Got the job done. And we saw it the next week against Miami, as you said, buddy. And, you know, here we are thinking, all right, this could work. This could work for four games. Then the injury, and then boom. Say, hey, I'm intrigued as hell to see if part two can work here. And, you know, I'm fully of the mindset that the Niners want to get out. If I'm Bill Belichick and I'm sitting at Miami's pro day today, I'm again every day on the phone with the Niners. Let's just get this done and move on.
Mm-hmm. But I think San Francisco guys, I think he risks alienating the team, and whoever it is, Lynch and or Kyle Shanahan makes that deal. And I just think he's going to stay. And I hope I'm wrong because I love the story here in New England, although I'm not a diehard Pats fan. I like Bill Belichick, and I've really kind of grown because of other people's disdain for this man who's done so many good things to your organization. So I'd love for him to throw his middle finger up to the fan base. It'll never happen. But I would love the story. But what is at stake as a player in San Francisco? Because you risk losing that team, don't you, by making this move?
You could, but I'm going to tell you what I think this is. I'm not a big TV guy. I can't even turn on my Netflix box. But I will tell you, this is like the season two of Jimmy G coming. Like
mm-hmm.
The season one wasn't the end of the show. That's just totally the way I look at this. And, yes, I don't know how to control my Netflix.
So good. Let me say one thing. I want to see Cam Newton on the Patriots in one way, shape, or form as a hype video consultant. That's it. Done. See ya.
Great work if you can get it.
Great work. Learn a salary. Go ahead, John.
All right, I'll let you guys wrap up. I'm sorry. I feel like I hijacked your show.
No, buddy, dude. Buddy, no, you're our resident draft expert, man. Always appreciate the time. I'm glad you called in. It was great stuff.
All righty. Have a good one.
Thanks,
you buddy.
Sorry, bud. That's Buddy Andrade, our E2G draft guru, and he loves the draft, and you can tell. I mean, you want to talk about in his wheelhouse, all you do is say NFL draft, and he lights up like a Christmas tree. So we thank Buddy Andrade for kind of joining us in on short notice today. But, yeah, John, this whole Garoppolo thing, man, I'm rooting for it. And like you said, because I think you're right. I think with what Miami's done and what Buffalo's doing and what they've done in the offseason – there's no way you can hand the keys to this car to Cam Newton come July. It's come opener season, week one of the NFL season. Can't do it.
Yeah, here's hoping, because, again, we spent all of last season. Can't roll out Cam Newton again this week, can he? He's
mm-hmm.
going to at least see some other options. and he never did. So, again, Belichick's mind is a place unlike no other. That, you know, he has it set to be one way, and if he doesn't get it his way, then, you know, he's not moved to go, you know, take that other fork in the road. But
right.
I think even he sees that that guy cannot be handed the keys to this vehicle because you've done so many good things to turn around everything in a hurry, and you don't often get those chances to flip the switch so quickly. And you do have that chance here to get everybody back in the good graces and show everybody what you know. Because, again, you went 7-9. You had a lousy quarterback. You were still competitive in every game. You had a chance to beat the likes of Kansas City, Buffalo, Seattle, Miami down there, Houston down there. Because, again, Houston only won four games, but, you know, what Watson was doing at that point in time was just crazy. You didn't lose the locker room, and now with 29 moves, you've been able to turn this thing over, but you're still missing that one piece at the most important spot on your roster, and that could derail everything you've done.
No question about it. What I'm liking is, and this is a couple more minutes left in our E2G Sports Going Old School podcast, John Crow, John is here for you. E2GSports.com is where you will find this podcast. And we're going to get into some things that John's writing for the website in just a moment. But I do want to say one thing, John. It's going back to the old glory days in the AFC East when you had Buffalo, Miami, and New England competing for a division. I like it. I think competition will get the best out of Belichick as a coach, knowing what's around him. And the Jets will get a high draft pick. So they're going to be on some back pages of the Daily News and the Post just because of notoriety and a new beginning. So you're looking at a Patriot team that has no choice now but to step it up in a division that they basically owned for 20 years and owned, by week 10 or 12, they were popping champagne corks in the division and passing out hats. So it's going to be nice from that standpoint to see some old teams with a lot of history strap it back on and be competitive once again in the AFC East.
Yeah, to put on my wrestling hat for a minute, WWE. Back when they were the WWF, they got complacent. They didn't put the rejuvenation into what they were doing creative-wise until WCW came along with Monday Night Nitro. So once they had a viable competitor, they said, uh-oh, we're getting beat now. We've got to ramp it up. And they changed it from a million-dollar corporation to a billion-dollar corporation.
Right.
They're doing it again now because they have competition with All Elite Wrestling. It happens. But it's how quickly you can make that pivot that determines where your franchise will go.
I like it. John Crow, tell us about what's coming up on E2GSports.com and what's rolling around your head from the crow's nest, if you will.
Well, now you can read This Week in the WWE. My column is now up on E2GSports.com. We've made the transition. It is up there. Huge change in the main event at WrestleMania. Check it out. And coming up this weekend, we'll only be 1 week away from WrestleMania, and we'll tell you what is going to happen.
You got it, John. Quickly before we go out, who do you like in today's NCAA matchup? Any upsets, or are you going chalk?
Hart wants some chalk to not be, you know, written out. But you know what? Unfortunately, I think it is going to be chalk tonight, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Because I think Baylor's too good. They're going to sniff out Arkansas, and Houston will take out Oregon State. I hope not. I hope it's Baylor and hope it's Oregon State moving on, but I don't think it's going to happen.
And that's how we tune in, man. It's great, and that's what makes this tournament madness. I'm going chalk as well. But tune in tonight. Elite Eight action starting at 7:15 roughly on CBS. And for John Crow, this is Johnny Sunshift's Buddy Andre. Thanks for joining us. And Jerry Palm, obviously. Always appreciate his time as he gave us some NCAA Tournament March Madness tidbits. JC, always a pleasure, man. Thanks. We'll do it again soon.
You bet. Have a good week.
You bet, man. But John Crow, Johnny Sanchez, thanks again to all the E2G listeners. Thank you for your support. Have a great day. Take care. Be well and stay safe.